The U.S. defense industry is large, complex, and competitive. It is also lucrative for those companies able to navigate it successfully. The American Society of Military Comptrollers helps bridge the gap between the boardroom and the battlefield while supporting transformation in the defense sector. The Business of Defense podcast brings you inside the companies working to achieve this, directly from the business leaders, and to understand how they create value for their companies and their customers. For more information on ASMC, visit asmconline.org.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in financial markets. I'm your host, Nathaniel Baker. Okay, today's podcast is doing things a little bit differently. We're not talking about stocks or bonds or economies or recession or yield curves or anything like that. Instead, we are talking about management and governance of public companies. Now, the general assumption here is that public companies manage themselves pretty efficiently. Obviously, there are certain exceptions, but we usually hear about these maybe when there's an activist situation or private equity takeover. But what if these aren't exceptions? And what if the general premise that companies manage themselves efficiently is false? That is the thesis of my guest today, Henry Wolff. Henry has written a book called Governance Arbitrage. The subtitle is Blowing Up the Public Company Governance Model to Maximize Long-Term Shareholder Value. And the idea here is that, and I quote, "It is time to admit that the public company governance model is broken." Generally, he says that the board of a company is an undervalued and underutilized asset that's concerned primarily with compliance and oversight. Further, radical transformation of the current model is required to unlock the full potential of the board and maximum company value. This is the thesis of our guest today, Henry Wolff, and I was pleased that he took time out of his busy schedule to sit down with me for a phone call where he discussed his book, the governance model, and several other things. It's a very interesting conversation, and I'm sure you will find it educational. But before I push play on this recording, I would like to remind you once again that nothing that we say here on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Everything is for informational purposes only. With that, let's get to it. Enjoy.
So obviously you've done a lot of work around corporate governance and board inputs into companies' performance. And there's a lot that apparently that companies are doing wrong. So maybe you can just talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, let me just talk about the underlying thesis of the work I've done and the underlying thesis of my book, and I think that kind of that'll set the stage for it. I mean, the basic thesis is, and this is a critical point. The point I'm getting ready to make is just essential. The foundation of the thesis is that the public company governance model, not the boards per se, but the governance model itself, is suboptimal, and that leads to underperformance of public company boards. It leads to the board as an undervalued asset, and to some degree, it also leads to underperformance of the company itself and over the long term shareholder value. And the argument that I make is that if you want to get the maximum out of company's performance, you want to get the best capital allocation, you want to get the best long term shareholder value, then the model itself needs to change.
Okay, the model of how public companies are managed, or yeah, it sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about the public company governance model, and granted, I mean, it's got multiple components, but it's primarily focused. It's a compliance focused model. The primary director selection is independence, and now you've got laid on top of that a big push for diversity. You've got when the chairman's position is separated from the CEO position, the only criteria is that the chairman be independent and that he or she is able to develop consensus. You do not have the board heavily engaged in understanding the business that they're involved in and how it creates value. In fact, just, you know, one data point or a couple of data points on that, in some in-depth studies that McKinsey has done, they determined that for public company directors, only 22% of directors completely understood how their firms created value, and only 16% understood the full dynamics of their company's industry. So that's just one simple data point in a fairly complex situation that points to the underperformance of the public company governance. And again, you know, my argument is that the underperformance is the result of the model itself.
Right. So are there any ways, short of taking these companies private, are there any ways that this can, for companies to optimize this, so that shareholder value can be optimized and shareholders can get the most out of their holding in this, in these companies?
Yeah, let me see if this is going to be a bit, if you can bear with me, a bit of a long-winded answer, but I'd like to answer it really in two phases. One, I'll be as brief as possible, but to describe what I believe it needs to be replaced with. And then secondly, address maybe the ways, because I don't think there's necessarily one way, the ways that this may be able to be accomplished. If you look at the contrast with the public company governance model, if you look at the top private equity firms and the governance model that they implement, it's almost a night and day. If you put the components of the public company governance model in a chart beside the key components of the private equity governance model, yeah, it's their polar opposites in each one of the criteria. And so my argument is that the private equity governance model, especially with the top private equity firms, it is a model that is focused strictly on maximizing the value of the business over the holding period. It's got a clear, crystal clear governing objective, and that governing objective then leads to how that board functions, the type of people who are on that board, et cetera, et cetera. So the fundamental argument, again, the title of my book is Governance Arbitrage, so to be able to get the arbitrage, you've got to be able to replace the existing model with something that is fundamentally better. I believe approximating, you'll never get all the way there, but I do believe approximating the private equity model is the way to go about improving and fairly materially improving the governance of public companies. Now, as to how that gets done, that's the $64,000 question.
I was going to say, is that even feasible?
I think that it's feasible, and I think it's to the degree it's feasible, it's going to come from activist investors. You already see pieces of that taking place, and I'll give you a perfect example of it. The other that I think it really probably will be, if this idea can take hold, I think it's going to be institutional investors that are going to have to play the key role in it. Activists can be certainly a part of it, but I think that institutional investors, you already see now the big institutional funds, BlackRock, State Street, Fidelity, putting pressure on corporate boards from certain angles. So if they have the ability to put pressure on boards, for example, to think in terms of long-term value creation, I'm not arguing with that. You know, the model I'm suggesting supports that. Would it not be possible that they could take it several steps further? And even if it's a gradual process, start pushing boards to move their model towards one that is more focused on company performance, more focused on value, but has all these other attributes that fill in the pieces that make all of that possible.
Okay, that's all very interesting. I do have a couple points on this, though. Now, private equity has a couple of distinct advantages over public companies, as you, of course, know. And one of them is not having to report to shareholders on a quarterly basis, not having to report publicly on a quarterly basis, which gives private equity a much more leeway to focus on the long term, where public companies may not have that freedom. And second of all is the whole mark-to-market thing. And when you have a public company that's publicly traded, the proof is in the pudding. The mark-to-market is what the share price is. And on the private equity side, it's a little bit more, a lot more complicated. and there is no mark to market really, and you can, you know, the company gets priced on a, I don't even know how often, I guess it depends on the deal and the ownership, but there's a lot, you know, many more moving parts, and it doesn't necessarily have to reflect all the prices that are current at that exact moment in time. So what do you make of that, those two shortcomings, and that those may be real obstacles when it comes to public company management?
Let me respond to that, and I certainly don't disagree with your points. I think that there are obstacles that you described. I think there are other obstacles.
Sure.
And I never suggested that this would be easy or it would be an overnight situation.
Hmm.
But let's take a specific situation to show the possibility of how it can work. And I'm sure you're familiar with this when Starboard Value replaced the entire board at Darden Restaurants.
Yeah.
Let me just take you through that and address sort of all the pieces that fit within what I'm suggesting here.
Okay.
At the time that Starboard did that, and I won't belabor all the details of what led up to them replacing the entire board, what's interesting first is if you look at the makeup of the Starboard board, of the nominees that they proposed, it fits to a T almost with what I'm proposing with this new model. They had a number of restaurant industry heavyweights, not with just experience, but with outstanding value creation track records. Mm-hmm. They had people on the board that were on there specifically for some of the major initiatives that they'd identified that would be the levers they would pull to create value. They had the perfect chairman in Jeff Smith, in somebody who's got general value creation experience in addition to leadership ability. So they created the type of board that I'm suggesting as far as makeup to replace the incumbent board. They created that type of board. So that, you know, that's step number one. And what they also did is something that, you know, that I believe needs to be done in every situation. Private equity does it. They set a longer-term EBITDA target, and they set a longer-term equity target. Now, granted, yeah, did they have to report on a quarterly basis? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that didn't waver that board. It didn't waver or cause Starboard to waver. It didn't cause that board to waver in what they were looking at out over a three-year period they projected. I might have the time frame, but it certainly wasn't something that was on a quarterly basis. They had a context to be able to implement the initiatives that Starboard identified, even though they had the pressure from the quarterly earnings. They certainly had the pressure that you noted from the mark-to-market. I would suggest that while Starboard was involved in that, I can't speak to it since they've stepped off and sold their position, but while they were involved, I would suggest that just about everything that I am suggesting in my book, and I use Starboard as the case study, that they implemented everything that I suggested in a public company. That's the best way I can respond, is through giving that example where all the pieces fell into place. Does that mean that there are no challenges? Absolutely not. The issues you raised are absolutely correct. But I still believe if I'm correct, and I believe that I am, that there's value for shareholders in shifting the model and doing it right, then I believe that some of these impediments will, over time, will be able to be overcome.
Mm-hmm. And to your point, did investors, the public investors in Darden, they didn't punish the company by selling shares once Starboard got involved?
Absolutely not. Yeah. In fact, I mean, keep in mind what the public company, Starboard did the proxy fight, and the public company investors had to vote for Starboard's full slate of directors, and they overwhelmingly voted for them. And then, no, they did not, to the best of my knowledge, they did not punish Starboard by exiting after Starboard got in place. I think, in fact, just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
The shareholders were thrilled and they stayed in, and of course the performance was there. EBITDA went from 600 some odd million to almost 1 billion, from 13 to 16, and the share price from 40 some odd dollars to $85. Both, interestingly enough, too, were in the range of the targets that Starboard set.
Very interesting. Okay, cool. I want to drill down and ask you some more questions about this, but let's first take a short break so we can identify ourselves and let listeners know where we can find more information. You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. You can find us on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, Google, anywhere else that podcasts are recorded, not recorded, but played and collected, just search for Contrarian Investor. We are also on the social media, on Twitter at PodContrarian, and we have a nascent Instagram account, which is ContrarianPod. Do get in touch with us with any feedback. You can email us at contrarianpod@gmail.com. Questions, concerns, feedback, suggestions. If you would like to suggest a guest, if you are an individual who thinks you could come on as a guest, all of that information should be communicated over email to contrarianpod@gmail.com. Now, Henry, what about you? Tell me a little bit about you and where we can find more information.
Sure. My name is Henry Wolf. I'm chairman of De La Vega Occidental and Oriental Holdings. I'm a private investor. My career has been, for the most part, spent on investing in companies that are underperforming, undergoverned. Most of it has been private companies. I've been involved as a partner with private equity also in transactions, and have done a couple of activist investments in public companies. I also just had a book published on March the 30th. The title of the book is Governance Arbitrage, Blowing Up the Public Company Governance Model to Maximize Long-Term Shareholder Value. And the basic thesis of the book I've talked about at the outset of the podcast. Best contact would be the book's website, which is governancearbitrage.com.
Cool, governancearbitrage.com. Check it out by all means. Yeah, very interesting thesis. And obviously, so you've been investing for a while. Now, can you talk to this a little bit, what you look for as entry points for when you're going to invest in a company?
Yeah, absolutely. The very first thing, I realize that this is a contrarian investment podcast. What I'm getting ready to give you is about as contrarian as it gets.
Great.
To a large degree. I will not invest in something. And I've been like this from the get-go. I won't invest in something. In fact, I have to have the thesis that there is weak management and or a weak board. And typically a weak board results in weak management. There may be some rare exceptions. But the point being is that I always look for the people side of the equation. Mm. And my thought is, obviously, you have to look. I mean, I'm not so naive that I don't think you have to look at the business, but I've also restricted myself to very simple manufacturing, wholesale distribution businesses. I'm not a tech guy. But I've always believed, and the thesis has been typically proved out, that if you can fundamentally change both the makeup and the focus of the board, and secondarily, if that results in a new CEO or a new senior management team, probably all the better. Then there is typically, unless you've just got a failing industry, there is typically a strong upside for shareholders. And that's been proven on multiple occasions. And that's, you know, big picture, my background and kind of how I look at things.
Now, that seems to require a certain activist bent, that, you know, what you're talking about, if it comes to replacing management, if it comes to bringing in new ownership or new people, that would require, like, getting involved on the board level, right, wouldn't it?
That would be correct, and I've gone about it from a number of different ways. In fact, the first hostile deal I did was my own family, taking them out of our family business. We had a major battle for 6 years over some of the issues that I've thought as far as performance, the board, et cetera. Saying that was the first battle. Other situations, they've always, yes, been an activist aspect of it. Sometimes in a number of cases, I bought the entire company. So the activist act is actually buying the company. In other situations, it's been as a minority investor and stirring up trouble, or in a few situations, it's simply been either going on the board or being named non-executive chairman and not having a big investment or any investment position, and gradually over time pushing for major change. So it's in my nature to do that. So I function as an activist basically in everything I get involved in. If there's really not a whole lot of need for any type of activism, I get bored pretty quickly.
Pretty cool. Do you feel that institutional investors, let me backtrack it real quick. it, obviously, to have that kind of impact, you need to buy up a pretty large portion of the company's shares. You know, 5%, I think, typically is what the threshold, which retail investors, for obvious reasons, can't do. But institutions can, and in many cases, institutions hold a large portion of the public shares and are not really involved with the governance aspect at all. They're almost completely silent partners. Do you find that to be true? And do you feel that there is more that institutional investors in particular can do when it comes to being active with management of public companies?
I think that there's more that they can do, I think you're starting to see some of it now. The prime example is Larry Fink's letters to the companies that he's invested in, advocating for board diversity, advocating for corporate social responsibility, and advocating for long-term value creation. So, yeah, I think that there is some of that. I think institutional shareholders can do more. I think that they could do more in regard to the evaluations of the boards and going beyond making suggestions that boards, quote, refresh themselves. You know, they may refresh themselves, but they're going to turn around and put the same kind of people that they had previously. I would like to see, obviously, with the thesis that I have, I would love to see institutional investors start taking a look at the possibility of there being a better governance model for public companies. If they're going to argue for more long-term focus, then this governance model, while it certainly doesn't preclude short-term situations like spinoffs or divestitures, it also is one that is a longer 3 to 5 to 6 year type of focus. So I would love to see them be able to get into that arena.
I wonder if we can reverse engineer your whole process a bit and locate companies where the management is doing what you might see is the right way of doing things, and which almost might serve as an optimal model for investors. And then if we might identify those as candidates to buy the public shares. Is there anything like that where you feel that the company is doing everything right or just about everything right?
Costco,
yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Full disclosure, I'm not a stock market investor per se, and I have no investment in Costco. The reason I bring up Costco is Costco's got a couple of elements on the board that are reflective of what I believe that you need to have as far as board members. First, they've got a non-executive chairman, Hamilton James, former president of Blackstone. He's currently executive vice chairman of Blackstone, the largest private equity firm in the world. He brings exactly to that board what I advocate in my book that a non-executive chairman brings. He brings value creation understanding. The best private equity guys understand value creation as well or better than anybody else does. And he brings that, obviously, being president of Blackstone formerly. He also brings the leadership ability. I don't think you could ask for a better non-executive chairman. You also have Charlie Munger on the board. You want success. One of the things I think that we're seeing huge shortfalls is we do not have enough sophisticated investors on boards, sophisticated investors bring completely different mindsets. They bring heightened capital allocation skills, and they bring a knowledge of value creation that your typical corporate executive and board members simply just don't have.
Right. Is there anything else as far as the boards and what they're doing wrong specifically, egregiously, that you think in general, what would you think is one of the biggest mistakes that they make?
The single biggest flaw in the model is that it does not have a clear governing objective.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with private equity. Private mm-hmm. equity's governing objective really encompasses, although they don't sit around and talk about it,
right.
it's just a given. It encompasses three things. One, to maximize or to optimize capital allocation and to maximize company performance and value over the long term. That's the context. Everything else for a private equity board and the model that I'm suggesting for public companies, everything else comes out of that context. How they function, their deep dive into understanding the business, their value maximization plan that they develop, the way they monitor the value maximization plan and hold management accountable. the types of outside directors they bring onto the boards. Competence is the only selection criteria for private equity. It's also what I suggest for public companies. Rather than the obsession with independence, the obsession with a whole slew of other things, that the primary selection criteria should be competence, but with competence defined relative to the value creation drivers of the particular company. From my standpoint, I realize that my theory regarding public company boards is one that's quite controversial, quite foreign, I'm sure, for a lot of people, but I think we've touched on just about all of the salient points from my view.
Okay, Henry Wolf, governancearbitrage.com is the website to his newly released book. Is that book available on Amazon and elsewhere?
It is available on Amazon and every other major online site. And from the website, you can order the book from every one of the sites, including the distributor. So easy to order it from the site or by going on just into Google and putting in governance arbitrage, and it'll throw up all kinds of options also.
Yeah, again, governancearbitrage.com, and the subtitle here I'm looking at is Blowing up the Public Company Governance Model to Maximize Long-Term Shareholder Value. Please do check it out. Henry Wolf, thank you so much for joining us on the Contrarian Investor Podcast.
Nathaniel, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks so much. And with that, we look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.